Hello, and welcome to the EdSurge podcast, a weekly look at the future of learning. I'm Jeff Young. I'm a reporter and an editor here at EdSurge. We're a nonprofit newsroom covering education innovation. When Felicia Russell was a high school student near Los Angeles, she was getting good grades and plenty of encouragement to go to college. Then it came time to start getting serious about doing the paperwork of actually applying to a campus.
We're starting to talk about like, hey, you're going to eventually have to apply for the FAFSA. You're going to go to college. So I'm like, hey, one of the things I know I need is a social security number. What is it? Where is it?
For some reason, her mom was vague about answering this one.
You know, it was ignored a little bit. And then finally, yeah, my mom was like, yeah, you don't have one.
Felicia didn't have a social security number because she didn't have permanent legal status in the U.S. She was undocumented. She had moved to this country from Jamaica when she was just a kid, but she hadn't fully understood until that moment, as she Googled for more details, how her immigration situation could dash her dreams.
I graduated high school in 2010, right? So this was pre a lot of the work to move away from the word illegal to undocumented, right? And so that's all I saw online. Illegal, illegal, illegal. Can't go to college. You can't go to college. That was what was online.
On today's podcast, we hear the story of Felicia's fight to get her college degree and how she's become an advocate for other undocumented students. Her biggest message is that even when schools and colleges do work to help undocumented students, they often aren't paying attention to Black undocumented students because the majority of services in this space are designed for Latino students.
In a lot of ways, at the time, also made sense. And now some of it makes sense. Latinx population is 2/3 of the undocumented population. So it makes sense that everything is centered around their experience. But it's so dangerous, right? Because there's so many other people out there. Black undocumented immigrants are 6% of the population, right? There's 13% of us in higher ed, over 53,000 of the 408,000 of undocumented students, right? So they're there. And Asian undocumented students are there, right? 27%.
She knows the landscape well because she also serves as the director of the Higher Ed Immigration Portal, run by the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration.
Right. And so it's so dangerous because now we're forcing these people back into the shadows because now they don't have a space to belong. And then as a result of that, you know, you have other issues.
Felicia shares her story in a new book out this month called Amplifying Black Undocumented Student Voices in Higher Education. The book also includes deep research on the topic based on extensive interviews she did with 15 Black undocumented college students. And she has recommendations for school and college leaders on how to better support the full spectrum of students facing these issues. I started by asking Felicia Russell to take us back to her memories of growing up as a kid in Jamaica.
Yeah, so born in Jamaica, I talk about this in the book, but a small village, Johnsall, you know, everyone knew everyone. And I grew up with my grandma, and which is pretty common in immigrant families. You know, a child goes to live with the grandparent, and my mom, you know, eventually did migrate to the States. And so it kind of worked itself out. But yeah, grew up with my grandma, very strict. She was very strict, Seventh-day Adventist lady, always in church. We were in church all the time. I think I've had enough church for my entire life. And then, you know, I came to live with my mom in Inglewood, which is, you know, this lower income neighborhood in South Central LA. And completely different, right? She wasn't a Seventh-day Adventist. She wasn't going to church all the time. So that was great. That was freedom that I did not know I needed, but I loved
it. And how old were you? When you made that transition?
I was about to be 12. So going on 12. And, yeah, I remember, you know, thinking like, oh, we're about to go to church on Saturday and no church. And it was exciting, right? As a 12-year-old kid, you're like, oh my gosh, I don't have to go to church anymore. I don't have to go to church every day of the week. So I, you know, got into basketball, was playing basketball, continued getting some good grades.
It sounds like you remember what you thought of when you thought of America living back in Jamaica before you arrived.
Yeah. So I think a lot of kids from third world countries, they have this vision of what America is like, right? So for me, I thought big buildings, snow all the time, right? Just amazing, you know? And I remember when I landed at LAX and there were a lot of big buildings, but it was so different from what I expected. And there was no snow. First of all, I was in California and I thought snow was everywhere, right? No matter if you're in LA or New York, it was snow because America is just one big place. That's what I thought as a kid. So no snow.
I'm picturing like some scene from like a New York movie where the snow is in the shop windows. That was your mind. Yeah.
Which is a scene we all have in our mind. But cars everywhere, McDonald's everywhere, liquor stores everywhere. I was like a kid in a candy store. I remember just like looking out the window. My mom's driving us from the airport, just like admiring every single detail. Right. And I remember this in detail, right? Even when I got into the house, like even just like the click of like flushing the toilet, I was like, oh, we could flush the toilet inside. Right. I grew up in a very poor area where, you know, the bathroom was outside. It was the ground, right? Like it wasn't an actual bathroom that you could go and flush. You can't get water inside. You got to walk to the river to go get water. So all of that was so cool to me. I remember I flushed it like four times when my mom came in like, please stop doing that. Right? Like don't flush, don't waste the water. But I was just so intrigued by it. But yeah. And then I, you know, started middle school and there's a lot of differences with, you know, the schooling. A lot of the work that we were doing, I'd already done it, right? And so right away, I was kind of recognized as like a smart kid. But really, I remember thinking like, I'm not smart. I've done this work already. Like I would say to my teachers, I did this work already. So I got placed in magnet courses. So for, you know, students who are supposedly smarter than other kids. But I kind of found a tribe, which helped to make the transition a little bit easier. A lot of students in those courses were similar to me. They wanted to get good grades and all of that. So that kind of takes us a little bit to through middle school to about eighth grade.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like in your particular circumstance, you know, there was a bit of it seems like there was kind of a land of opportunity moment there in the early days. Like you were sort of, it sounds like your mom had been able to set up a stable situation and things were, you know, more resourced, so to speak. Obviously, you know, for better or for worse, but it sounds like there were some of the things being fulfilled about this, like, economic prosperity, maybe, at that stage.
Yeah, so, you know, like I said, so Inglewood, at the time, completely different now, right? We got SoFi Stadium and all the coffee shops and everything in Inglewood. So completely different from when I was growing up there, but pretty low income area, a lot of gangs. And, you know, we lived in a 2-bedroom apartment and it was me, my brother, my sister, my mom, her partner. Right. And so it was a few of us crammed into that apartment. I thought it was great. Right. Coming from Jamaica, for me, it was like, this is amazing. We had a big TV. We had access to cable, just all the things that we didn't have access to. So when you're, you know, kind of used to one thing, whether you know or not, right, like that this is not necessarily economic prosperity, but advancement to you as a kid, you're like, here it is. This is what it's about. Right. And, you know, as you get older, you kind of understand it. Like as I got older, I realized, oh, we live in Inglewood, California. Not necessarily the best neighborhood, right? You don't necessarily live in the best house. You don't have access to all the things that certain people have access to. You have to walk to school and, you know, and things happen, right? Dangerous things happen, you know, as you're walking to school. But yeah, my mom had, you know, kind of figured out a way to, you know, ensure and take care of us. But We still struggled a lot. But for me, community was so important, right? So I mentioned I found my tribe right away, like a bunch of friends right away as soon as I got placed into that magnet classes, right? And these were young women that were like, they cared a lot about their grades. Actually, it's so interesting because I owe my friends, and there's a lot of them are still my friends today, so much credit because they don't know, and I didn't know at the time, but they had so much impact on me in the continued, like, hey, get good grades. That's important. My grandma was very big on education, right? Like, when I came home from school every day, I had to read for 30 minutes. I hated it, right? Like, every day, right? And she checked my assignments and all of that. Coming here was a little bit different, right? My mom didn't go too far in school, right? And so she didn't necessarily understand all the benefits of education. Obviously, she knew as a parent we should be in school, all of that. But, you know, like, my report cards, there was no checking of my report cards, right? Like, my friends would always, like, talk about, I could get, you know, what's going to happen if I go home with a C? And I'm like, I guess, right? Like, I didn't think about, but they all, like, worked so hard, and I wanted to keep up with them. And so, you know, that's kind of how I maintained those good grades in middle school, even moving forward to high school, was really because a lot of my friends were getting good grades. I'm like, I got to keep up with these other students, right? But I didn't understand it. I didn't understand it at the time. But the goal was to create a life that, you know, was different from the one that we had. And, you know, I know this is kind of taboo right now to talk about, but for me, I remember watching the Cosbys on TV, and I was like, oh, that's the type of life that you want, right? And what do you have to do to get it? Education. And so for me, education was like, became this like big thing. It was like, it is going to be the vehicle to my success, because I'm not going to be a basketball player. I played basketball, but I wasn't that good. You know, I was no Caitlin Clark,
yeah, we're right? All enjoying watching that right now, but yeah, well, nobody else is.
Exactly. So I knew that wasn't going to be it. And so education, that was going to be it.
It sounds like you found yourself kind of looking and expecting to go to college. And it sounds like there was a day in high school where you found out that maybe your path to college was not going to be as easy as other kids.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there were a few moments, right? You don't really understand it, but there are a few moments, and then there are really pivotal moments that say, yes, there it is, right? So one, I played basketball, and so we had some travel time, and social security thing came up a bit, but not too much. We were middle school, then high school. And then, like, the ID started coming up, driver's license, right? I actually was listening to someone the other day, and she was saying she grew up in New York. So this idea of a driver's license never really came up until she was, like, grown, right? But
I know some friends in New York who still don't have driver's license.
Right, yeah. Exactly. In California, in though, you need it, right? And so that came up. And because I was doing well in school, there was a lot of conversation that was directed to me about, like, hey, Felicia, you're going to go to college because you have really good grades. So, you know, that became ingrained into my reality, even though it didn't make sense because no one in my family had gone. But I was like, okay, cool, great. And, you know, like I said, I was seeing it on the Cosby Show. And I'm like, all right, that's it, right? But I remember, you know, bringing it up a few times, you know, it was ignored a little bit. And then finally, my mom was like, yeah, you don't have one, right?
And I'm sorry, it being?
A social security number.
Right. So you needed a social security number to, like, apply for a FAFSA, or somebody
to
said,
apply
like,
for FAFSA.
Okay, just give me that information.
Exactly, right? So we're starting to talk about, like, hey, you're going to eventually have to apply for the FAFSA. You're going to go to college. So I'm like, hey, one of the things I know I need is a social security number. What is it? Where is it? You don't have one, right? And it was casual, right? It didn't mean anything to me in the moment necessarily. I was like, oh, okay. Eventually I started to look it up, which is a mistake, because at the time, right, I graduated high school in 2010, right? So this was a lot of the work to move away from the word illegal to undocumented, right? And so that's all I saw online. Illegal, illegal, illegal. Can't go to college. You can't go to college. That was what was online.
Right. So it was essentially your immigration status was going to keep you from doing the one thing you sort of, that was the plan.
That was the plan, right? Like, that was the plan. And so I remember just feeling devastated, right? Like, I didn't, you know, I'm 14, 15. I don't really understand the gravity of it, but I now see that my path might be different from my classmates because I knew they were all born in America. So it's not like I had a friend that I was like, oh, this one's also from Jamaica. This one's also from Barbados. Maybe I should say to them, hey, have you guys thought about this social security number thing, right? And because of the images I saw online, everything that I saw online, the narrative was really daunting. And so I did not believe I was like, I can't tell anyone. And also that's the message I was getting at home. You can't tell anyone, you know, you could get in trouble. You could get deported, like whatever. Right.
Right. So, I mean, now you talk about it as undocumented, but essentially in your mind at the time, you were like, I'm an illegal immigrant.
Exactly. I'm an illegal alien. Right. That's what I was seeing.
Oh, you're right. I forget that was so much the word all the time. Alien.
Yeah, exactly. That was the word. And so now I was ashamed. I was ashamed and it felt like a secret. And I say this all the time to young people, and I don't remember where I heard it, but I talk about, you know, at the heart of secrecy is shame. And at the heart of privacy is something sacred, right? So thinking about the difference between keeping something a secret versus keeping something private. In keeping something private, there's something at the core you're trying to protect. In keeping something a secret, there's shame there, right? And so in high school now, I was ashamed of who I was because I thought that really is it. This is going to define me, right? It's going to ruin my life. It's why no one else in my family has gone to college. You know, I can't do it as well. This is the cycle. So I'm going to repeat this cycle, right?
And it sounds like in the short term, you know, you were flying high and really succeeding in your grades and stuff, but it didn't stay that way when you had this feeling, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. So I was a pretty, like I said, a curious kid, asked a lot of questions, and I made a lot of decisions. And so once I found that out, I was at a small charter school, City Honors High School in Inglewood, right behind Inglewood High School, which was for high achieving students at the time. I don't know if it's the same right now, but that's where I was. I made the decision I was going to transfer to a large public school because in my mind, if I transfer to a large public school, there will be no more attention on me about going to college because they don't know I can't go. And so I made the decision that I should transfer. So I transferred to Losinger High School.
Because your mom was a bit hands off on this and you were just like, I'm switching.
Yeah, yeah, I'm going to switch. This will be good for us, right? And I made the decision to go to Losinger High School in Lawndale, California. I had a graduating class of over 700 students, right? So I was like, oh, perfect. I will get lost here. Right?
You could be anonymous. Yeah.
I can be anonymous. And
wow, that's more than twice the size of my high school that I went to in Georgia. I was a public high school, but that sounds like, I just can't imagine that size. That's big.
It's huge, right? And then I was coming from City Honors where my graduating class was probably 35. Right. It was, I knew everyone in my class. Right. So it was a drastic change. But in parentheses, unfortunately, but fortunately, I had a great counselor, Mr. George Torres, who I write about in the book, but he has a pseudonym in the book, and which now everybody will know who he is, but he doesn't care. That was for purposes just to keep everyone anonymized. But he was amazing. And he, you know, reached out to me. Hey, we got to meet. You got to talk about your classes. You're a new student. And I remember I met with him. His office was very inviting. You know, he had a lot of just posters and things everywhere. And I talked to counselors today about that, how your office can really inform the comfortability of students. They can come into your office and know, like, this person might be an ally for LGBTQ plus issues or immigrant issues, or, you know, they might want to, you know, push you towards STEM, like whatever it is, your office.
Oh, wow. So you still remember some of the details in this office.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He had pictures of his family. He had, you know, like quotes. I don't remember the quotes exactly, right? But he had quotes about, like, immigrants and, you know, supporting them and all of that, right? And right. It was so inviting, you know, obviously I didn't share anything with him the first few times I met with him. And one of the things we went back and forth about, and we talk about this till to this day, because he and I still have a really good relationship, is that, you know, he's like, oh my gosh, you have such good grades. We have to put you in all advanced placement courses.
Advanced placement, headed to college.
And I remember I said, no, I don't really want to do AP courses, you know, this year. I just want to be in some regular classes, regular in parentheses, because, you know, they're not regular. But, and we made a deal. He said, well, how about you take a college class online, and then I put you in one AP or two AP classes, I think, something like that. And then your other classes could be regular. And I was like, ah, sure, whatever. But I did terribly. I was like failing math. Math is not my subject anyway. So on top of like, you know, feeling discouraged, being at a new school, being an AP, you know, whatever it was at the time, not a good combo of things. And so I didn't do well in math. I think I didn't do well in science. I don't remember. I didn't do well. Like all of a sudden my GPA fell. And I remember after the end of the semester, we talked about it and he's like, what happened? And I think that's at the point where I was like, I should probably tell him. And I think this is someone I should tell. I remember closing the door and telling him, and he was amazing.
So yeah, you said like, here's why I'm a little skittish about school. Cause you know, do you remember how you said it even? Or?
You know, I remember obviously I said, I'm undocumented. I found out I'm undocumented. And I can't go to college. And cause that's me as a kid, I made my decisions. I understand like, here's what it is. And you know,
right. That was the information you had.
Yeah. And, he was very, what's the word I'm looking for? But he received it very well. I remember he said, that's tough. And he asked some, you know, other questions about home and stuff like that. But he said, you could go to college. It's going to be hard, but you can go to college. We'll figure it out. We'll get you some scholarships, all of that. And I remember like just a weight fell. I don't know, 5 pounds fell off of me. And I was like, oh. Okay, I can go to college. Yep, you can go to college. And then, you know, he starts to tell me a little bit more of things I don't remember now, but like about policy and all that stuff. AB 540, I think, was the what was going around at the time. And he was saying, like, that's how they're going to classify you as AB 540, but da-da-da, all of that. And I said, all right, I'll go do better. And so next semester I went and got my grades back to where they usually were, right? And I was working with Mr. Torres where he's like, you're going to get there. And, you know, another thing that was monumental was he was like, we have a club here. It's private. It's secret. Right. But you should go because there's other students here that's in that position. I was excited. I'm like, are you kidding me? There's other students here that are. I was so excited.
So this was a secret organization for undocumented students just because of your own to protect the status of these, to protect the not get deported or feel, yeah, threatened. Yeah.
Just so exciting. And, you know, I talk about this in the book as well, but it was an interesting experience because the students in the club, there were no other Black students there. Right. And I was at Losinger High, which is predominantly Black and Brown students. So it wasn't like you weren't always in class with Black students and Brown students. And so when I got to the meeting, no one there looked like me. I'm like, whoa, okay. And then, you know, a situation in the book where a student went, and it's funny too, because I remember the student, and I can never say where they went off to college because they went off to this very prestigious school. But I know that the moment I say that, everybody who was in that room will know exactly what it is. So I don't ever say what school they went off to because they didn't mean anything by it, right? It wasn't a malicious question. It was really a protection question. Like, why is this person invading our space now? They've seen our faces. And the advisor was like, yeah, well, she's from Jamaica. She's undocumented. She's supposed to be here. And that has influenced my experience as a Black immigrant like forever, right? I didn't go back to any of those meetings. I did work with that advisor though on my college apps privately, but I just didn't feel comfortable.
So here was the group that you were going to have this feeling of like, oh, we can talk about
sense of belonging,
and
right?
And you came in and you felt like excluded by of just a moment of like, why is she here?
Exactly. Yeah, it was a space where I was going to go find a sense of belonging, right? That's where I was going to go find my people. And, you know, I think too about, you know, if I would have went back to that group, those meetings, maybe the experience would have changed, right? But I didn't go back. But that wanting of belonging eluded me, even in college, right? It never happened, because that's how the spaces were designed. They were designed to serve the Latinx student, which in a lot of ways at the time also made sense. And now some of it makes sense. Latinx population is 2/3 of the undocumented population. So it makes sense that everything is centered around their experience. But it's so dangerous, right? Because there's so many other people out there. Black undocumented immigrants are 6% of the population, right? There's 13% of us in higher ed, over 53,000 of the 408,000 of undocumented students, right? So they're there. And Asian undocumented students are there, right? 27%, right? And so it's so dangerous, because now we're forcing these people back into the shadows, because now they don't have a space to belong. And then as a result of that, you know, you have other issues. Overcriminalization, lack of advocacy, nothing, right? And that was my experience. And I realized, like, that's what I need to do, right? I need to bring visibility to this marginalized within the marginalized, right? Like, this group that's already on the margins, further on the margins, right? Yeah, but you know, I give a lot of credit to Mr. Torres, one of my favorite people, because when I tell you that, even in the research, and I'm sure we'll get to this in the research that I've conducted, the breakdown happens right there in high school when a student decides, because typically all of these students are college bound, right? And so everybody's like, you got to go to college. And so they have to figure out a moment, well, who do I tell? Who do I trust? And educators, we're supposed to trust them. They are supposed to know what to tell us, right? That's what we think as students. They know all of it. They get it. Just like how we think of our parents. They have, maybe not. Maybe we don't think that about our parents. Parents just don't understand what Will Smith said. But we at least believe that for teachers, right? And in that research, I realized that's always the breakdown. I mean, I interviewed people who were the same age as me. When I was 30 and they were 30 or 31, 32, same. And their trajectory is so drastically different because of that moment in high school when they decided to tell a teacher or a counselor, and the counselor said, oh, you can't go because you're undocumented, or versus Mr. Torres, who said, oh, okay, yeah, it's going to be difficult, but you can go and I will help you, right? Which he did, right? In so many ways. Beyond my applications, he helped me appeal to sit. Like, he was amazing, right? But yeah. So that's where the breakdown happens is in high school.
Yeah, and it sounds like for your book, Amplifying Black Undocumented Student Voices in Higher Education, you tell your story as part of it, but you also sat down with a number of, 14, I think, of these other Black undocumented students who tell you their stories as well. And so what are some of the themes? Like, tell me where you sort of allude to where it didn't go as well as it went for you. So talk about some of the others' experiences that you encountered as you told these stories.
So Amplifying Black Undocumented Student Voices in Higher Education is part memoir and part research. And I did not want to write a book that was engulfed with academic jargon. I wanted the layperson to be able to pick up the book, right? Someone who might like to read a memoir, might pick it up and read the first four chapters, because that's my story through my educational lens. And a professor, you know, grad student, whoever it is, a policymaker might be excited about chapters 5 through 7, right? Because it's focused on or centered around this qualitative study that I did, where I interviewed 15 Black undocumented people. They had either navigated higher education already, or they were currently navigating higher education. And I really wanted to understand, what is your experience as a Black undocumented person on a college campus? And some of the themes that came up was, one, they feel invisible, right? They feel invisible, not just in undocumented spaces, but in Black native college spaces, right? Which was actually surprising for me because I didn't have that experience. So that was one theme that I really had to dig a little bit deeper into because, like I mentioned, I came, I found my tribe right away. My friends love Jamaican music. They love Jamaican food. So I never felt othered in that group. Now, you know, obviously when I went on to college, I didn't have that same community. But because I had that already, I didn't really have this experience. And, you know, I was in the Black Student Union at Cal Lutheran. But again, Jamaican culture is really embraced a lot by Black students, Black people, Black Americans in general. So that was one of the things that came up, right? A lot of students who identified as Nigerian or they were from Haiti, wherever. Even I had, you know, three Jamaicans that I interviewed, and they also experienced this thing where in Black student unions, they were like, they felt invisible because the conversation was never around the Black experience, right? The wideness, the range of the diaspora. It was, let's talk about Black Americans. That's the experiences about this. So invisibility in undocumented spaces and Black spaces, a lack of belonging, right? In both of those spaces, right? They just didn't feel like they belong. And again, a lot of that was because everything was centered not around their experiences. Storytelling, a lack of storytelling that included Black immigrant voices. You know, a lot of things came up, you know, mental health issues. There were themes related to students who didn't have DACA, right? Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. They didn't have that status. So their status was even further pronounced, right? Not only were they Black and undocumented, but they didn't have DACA. And a lot of the services and scholarships and everything on college campuses these days are for DACA students. So a lot of those themes came up, and I dig deeper in the book, talking about sense of belonging and invisibility and, you know, what those lead to if we don't work to amplify and include Black undocumented people. So we can basically kind of make the conversation a little bit more nuanced, right? Because one thing I want people to walk away from, you know, if they listen to me or if they read this book, is that I'm really just trying to include other voices in the conversation. I'm not saying let's not talk about Latinx students. I'm saying let's make the conversation a little bit more smarter, a little bit more nuanced, right? Right? Because so many of us exist. And if you think about it, you know, if professors, faculty, staff, and other students are unaware of the diversity of the undocumented population, we can't serve them, right? We can't serve them. It's why Black immigrants are twice as likely to be deported. They represent 20% of deportation rates, even though they're only 6% of the population. They're six times more likely to be sent to solitary confinement when in ICE proceedings, right? This is all a result of being invisible and being Black, right? Because Black people are overcriminalized, period, in America. So I talk a lot about that in the book. So that part is for the nerds who like research and, you know, and then the first half of the book are for people. But it's for everyone. You can read it all. You can read it all the way through. It's pretty digestible, too.
Yeah, no, and I'm I think we have a lot of probably both in our audience, certainly plenty of nerds that will identify and want to know what you recommend. And I know that you are actually beyond the book, very active in this issue now, in basically raising, you know, amplifying in other ways too, and helping get resources to folks. So what are some interventions that you're hoping, you know, come to the fore from not just raising awareness, but then once that awareness is there, you know, what else can educators and policymakers do when they get this more nuanced view of the immigrant population?
Yeah, great question. So I think I think about it in three different buckets. The first is higher education institutions and what can they do? And I'll talk about a few things. So the first thing is, you know, a lot of higher ed institutions, they are now you know, they'll have like a liaison or someone on campus to support undocumented students. Or, you know, if you're California, you have undocumented student resource centers. So physical spaces on campus for undocumented students. One of the things we should and need to do is think about diversifying the hiring of staff who work with undocumented students, right? So again, to my point about visibility, right? If you're a Black student, you go to this center, it's for undocumented students, and not one staff member is Black, already you do not feel like you belong because no one there looks like you, right? And so we really have to think about how to reflect, to mirror the diversity of the population. And that we do by diversifying our hiring, you know, how we think about our hiring practices to support those students. So that's one. The other piece to think about for higher ed institutions are programming and even speakers. So think programming, events, speakers, right? When you think about, and I do a lot of talks at universities, and one of the things I always say to them is audit your programming from last year. Do a quick audit. Tell me how many Black speakers you had. Typically, it's none. Every now and then you get one, right? And so they need to audit their programming and events and the people that they bring in. Again, it needs to mirror the diversity of the population. Bring Black immigrants in, bring undocumented Asian people in, bring, you know, undocumented European people in, bring undocumented queer people in, because that's so important to move the needle, right? So audit the policies, audit the programming, the events, make sure that you're bringing folks in. And then the third thing, and then I talk about a few more in the book, so hopefully folks will go pick it up and read it, is think about cross-campus collaboration, right? So remember I talked earlier about, you know, just students going to like a BSU and not feeling like they're welcome. Black student unions on campuses should be partnering with the folks who are working with undocumented students, right? There needs to be a lot of interaction with those different offices and not working in silos. So those are three things higher ed institutions can think about. From the policy perspectives, right, the American Dream and Promise Act, we need to push policymakers to pass that. That will be instrumental for Dreamers, DACA recipients, all of that. And we can think also about how to, push more policies to expand tuition equity, right? And so undocumented students don't necessarily have access to in-state tuition rates in certain states, even though they grew up in those states, right? And so we need to push policymakers to create access to in-state tuition rates in certain states that undocumented students don't have access to that.
Yeah, I was interested. So you were classified as an international student and therefore had a very high tuition, I imagine, compared to—
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And that's what a lot of, you know, undocumented students go through. Because if you don't have access to in-state tuition rate in a specific state, then you are classified as an international student. And, if someone else is paying $15,000 for tuition, you might be paying more. So right now, 24 states in DC provide access to in-state tuition rates for undocumented students. And, I oversee the Higher Ed Immigration Portal right now for the President's Alliance. And on the portal, we talk a lot about that. We do a lot of analysis about this. So again, 24 states in DC provide in-state tuition to undocumented students. Of those states, 18 also provide access to state financial aid for undocumented students. And Massachusetts was one of the most recent who passed in-state tuition for undocumented students, right? And so we definitely have to move the needle there as well, because we know that one of the biggest barriers to higher education is cost. And, undocumented students already can't fill out the FAFSA. So we need to do this. So that's for policymakers. And then immigrant orgs should think about storytelling, including Black immigrant stories and the stories that we tell. And also, again, back to the cross-campus collaboration thing that I mentioned for campus, thinking about disrupting programming, right? So that looks like Immigrant Heritage Month go beyond just the Latinx storytelling, right? Women's History Month, start talking about immigrants, right? Or even recently, I did a report with the Center for Law and Social Policy where we talked about the experiences, or we analyzed the experiences of Black immigrant students on at HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities. Are they uniquely positioned to serve Black immigrants? Yes, they are, right? Because the staff, the faculty are majority Black people and from the diaspora, right? So that's another place that we have to even start thinking about. Well, how do we ensure that Black immigrants have good experiences at HBCUs? Because they might actually have a different type of experience there. And that came up quite a bit, too, in my research, where some of the participants who went to HBCUs felt really comfortable and they didn't have some of the issues that other folks did. So those are some of the suggestions, and I detail a little bit more in the book.
Years after she first closed the door of her high school guidance counselor's office to tell him about her undocumented status, and once she had a PhD of her own, she gradually decided to go more public with her story. First, she wrote an anonymous op-ed for a publication. Then she did an interview for PBS as part of a docu-series they did, where she revealed her first name and last initial. And now she's written a book signed with her full name. I asked her why she made the shift and whether it worries her to be this public.
There's always anxiety about deportation. I don't think you ever get to a place where you're like, oh, I can't be. That's definitely not me. That's probably my biggest worry all the time. But, you know, that's a great question, Jeff. I think that when I really started to look back, so in 2020, when we're all struggling and we needed to sit at home and be still.
Oh, that pandemic. Yeah.
Yes, the pandemic made us so still. I got an opportunity to really think about what my impact could be, right? And how I wanted to impact the world, how I wanted to give back to the world. And at the time, you know, I was almost done with my doctorate degree. I knew I had a lot of privilege that other undocumented people didn't have, right? Because now I had these degrees and from really good institutions, and, you know, I had a good job and I had a good salary, you know, in a lot of ways kind of representing the American dream. And I wanted to give back. And one of the ways to do that was to share my story, because I wanted to move away from shame, right? And that's how you do it. You got to shed it, right? To move away from shame, you have to shed it. And so, and I realized, you know, every time I did share my story, it was met with open arms. Now, it doesn't mean that that's how it's being met now, that it's out in the world, right? We know that's not how it's being met by everyone. But I can pay attention to how it's being met by other folks or receiving it with open arms. And so I moved away from this scared kid who was so afraid to put that out, because really it was centered around fear at first, right? And shame. And now it's centered around the fact that I know I can impact others and that my story is bigger than me. Right. And the fact that I want to keep telling stories, not mine, right, but the stories of others, because that's how we change the world. Stories, right? Stories change the world. And I know mine is changing lives because I hear it all the time and people reach out to me and tell me. And I want other folks and their stories to continue to change lives as well. So that's kind of how I moved away from it, moving away from this fear and shame to, all right, now I got to create some impact. And now I have some privilege. There's no way I can just sit on this and make money and, you know, drive a nice car and not help others. So that's kind of how it is. But the anxiety around being public is always there. I don't think that part's going to ever go away.
And she's also pushing to expand protections for undocumented people who were brought to the U.S. as kids.
Yeah. So the American Dream and Promise Act would provide DACA recipients, Dreamers, TPS, which is temporary protected status, deferred enforced departure with conditional permanent legal status for 10 years, right? And so that's one policy that could really change the lives and push us forward to citizenship. And it needs bipartisan support. You know, the majority of the American society support a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers and DACA recipients because of the unique and the great contributions that we've made to the American economy, right? In terms of state and local taxes, right? Like in 2022 alone, DACA recipients earned an annual of $27.9 billion in wages, right? And contributed over $2.1 billion to Social Security and Medicare, right? And so they're buying homes. 30% bought homes in 2023 compared to the 17% in 2022, right? They're contributing $1.7 billion per year in state and local taxes, right? So it's not only just good for us, but it's good for the economy. It's good for America. And also, that's what we're about. We are a land of immigrants, right? And we are the American dream, which, you know, I don't want to give a false sense of meritocracy or anything like that, right? But like, that's so a policy like that would be good. In terms of my own status, you know, I think there is, I'm always working to, you know, for that to be better. And we'll just stay tuned for that part. Yeah.
Well, honestly, it's been a pleasure to meet you and thank you for sharing your story and all these, you know, kind of perspectives with us. So appreciate it.
Of course. No, thanks for having me.
This has been the EdSurge podcast. If you like the show, please take a minute to give us a rating on whatever podcast app you are listening to right now. And you can get show notes and more information about the podcast by signing up for our EdSurge podcast newsletter. Just go to edsurge.com and click on the word newsletters. There you'll find our other newsletters as well, linking to our great journalism. Our articles come out every day on our website, edsurge.com. This episode was written and put together by me, Jeff Young. You can find me on X at JR Young and on the web at jeffyoung.net. Editing this episode by Rebecca Koenig, and our music is by Komaku. We'll be back next week with more on the future of learning. Thanks for listening.